You're listening to Dramas Over Flowers with Saya, Anisa, and Porama.
Hi, I'm Saya.
I'm Anisa.
And I'm Porama.
And this is a special episode.
Yes. So, Porama has been in a extremely deep and large rabbit hole of research, and she has like lots of amazing information to bring us, and we are going to do a amazing history of the global rise of K-drama. Is that kind of what it is, Porama?
Kind of, yeah. Originally, I was interested in finding out how Netflix entering the Korean entertainment market has affected production inside the country, as in like what's happening with cost, budget, labor, who is contracted with who, who's like, who are the rivals? Those are the things that I wanted to find out, the gossip.
I kind of want to butt in here and say that originally you were meant to be doing your work.
That is also true. Originally I was meant to be doing my paid work. And because that is never what I really want to do, I went off into a rabbit hole of initially just like really old articles. And actually, a surprising number of them are on like major papers like Atlantic and Forbes and New York Times.
LA
and
Times,
somehow,
yeah.
Somehow we never saw them like in the mid-2010s when we were watching K-dramas. Those were not the articles we ever saw, but they exist. So it's nice to know that international fans have been doing the good job of, you know, reporting on dramas for quite a while.
Also, it's just good journalism, which we often don't see around K-dramas.
So I started from there, and then I ended up discovering research papers. And I've been getting into reading more and more research papers since like end of last year because of a totally different subject. And for some reason, I just didn't think there would be that many English language research papers around Korean drama, because what little I had seen until then, mostly through like searching on Google Scholar, was limited to this is the, I don't know, sixth Korean wave and it's popular in America and this is why Squid Game is so awesome.
And Netflix invented K-drama.
And these are also really like very recent, because when I was doing my thesis in like 2018 to 2020, there were like five that I found that I could use, you know, for my research. Like there just were so few. And I had to like go to Korean language research papers, which were like a lot of work to try to read, and because like academic writing in another language, that was hard. I feel like in the last 5 years, there's been such an explosion of academic research around this topic.
Yeah. And before we dive into our topic, I just wanted to briefly talk about something that a previous guest of ours, Professor Sirabar Seji, was discussing on Twitter recently about how Korean scholars, like Korean, like people living in Korea, don't often want to contribute to those edited journals where, you know, you submit papers in the English language. So you often have American scholars, maybe Korean American scholars, but you often have international scholars contributing to that, contributing to the conversation about Korea and Korean media in international journals and papers. So the reason that she laid out, if I understood it correctly, was because inside Korean academia, it's not worth much to publish your paper in these journals in this type of way. Like she explained it much better, and I will link to the thread in the description so you guys can read it, because I might be misinterpreting parts of what she said. But the heart of it that I understood was there is a reason why Korean scholars don't contribute to, or have not as yet contributed that much to, Anglophone discussion of Korean media in, like, you know, scholarly papers. And because it is very weird, just like Anisa said, that until recently there was almost nothing that we could find that was like deep and full of like data that we could actually bite down on, because there really wasn't. It was mostly opinion papers. And so it's been nice to lately find a few papers that were written by scholars who are connected to Korean academia. So The original pitch for this episode was me telling these guys that I want to talk about Netflix's growth in Korea. And of course, we've been sort of skirting around that subject for years at this point, right? We've been talking about the growth of streaming, how that's affecting change in storytelling. Will it be affecting it too much? Will global tastes sort of like become dominant over domestic tastes on Korean dramas? All of those questions. And that's a lot to talk about. But when I started like prepping for this episode, I realized before we dive into what Netflix did to the Korean production system, we need to actually talk about the Korean production system, like the K-drama, how K-dramas, the limited episode series that we are used to watch as international viewers, how did they become popular? How were they produced? What was the state of the industry before 2016 when Netflix arrived on the shores to speak? So that is what this episode is mostly going to be focused on. And we will do another episode where we are actually going to deep dive into what happens next. So we're going to leave you on a cliffhanger, fair warning.
And it won't even be episode 8.
No. Okay. So we begin our story in the 1990s. The Korean entertainment industry had already started exporting a few of their dramas, limited episode, like 20 episode dramas, to other Asia Pacific countries. So at this point, whenever I say they exported overseas, I'm talking about Asia Pacific countries like China, Japan, Thailand, Malaysia, just Asia Pacific. That's what overseas is. And during this period where they're slowly doing this, South Korea at this point is, it's in an interesting economic situation until things overheat to the point where we reach 1997 and the Asian financial crisis happens. Now, a lot of countries are affected during this crisis, but Korea is terribly afflicted. Like, a lot of investment flees the country. If you have watched 2521, you would remember, so women were basically asked to send in gold, anything, any money, any jewelry they had at home, they were giving to the government because the government was in such huge debt and they needed the money. So there is a lot of pride within Koreans who remember that time about how they helped their government survive. Other dramas that refer to this period, Reborn Rich did it.
Answer Me 1997.
Yeah, that one did it. So if you watch these dramas, you more or less have an idea of what this crisis was like for the people living through it. So during 1997, what happened was there was this one drama that was produced by MBC called What Is Love All About, whose Korean name is?
사랑이 뭐길래.
And this was exported to China. Now, the conditions of this export is actually hilarious. Before K-dramas had their first Korean wave, Japanese dramas were really popular across Asia Pacific. And all Asia Pacific countries were basically hungry for more content, especially highly produced content. And it's with this drama, What Is Love All About, going absolutely bonkers hit in China, that people started realizing that Korea could be a good place to get high quality, well-produced dramas. Again, high quality for that time, guys. Don't compare it to what we get now. The other funny thing was...
How could you?
No, but I appreciate Borma saying that because I've seen discourse on the internet saying I can't watch K-dramas produced before 2018 or something.
So it's painful. So you have at that point Japanese dramas exported airing rights were really expensive. So because of the Asian financial crisis, Korean entertainment was also getting a big hit. So what they were doing is they were exporting the dramas at that point, not just this drama, but a lot of other dramas at 1/5 the price that Japanese dramas were asking for. So a lot of those countries were like, yeah, that's
dirt cheap.
Yeah, they became dirt cheap. So a lot of those dramas were like, yeah, well, this is not very high stakes. We might as well try. So they took those dramas, put them on their own channels, and suddenly Korean dramas started just gaining a following. People were exposed to this new format, this new language, and it was clearly taking off. So like I said, they started dirt cheap, but just in the next 5 years, they produced a lot of dramas and exported it between those years. But the most interesting thing is Winter Sonata came out in 2002, and it created brand Korea as far as entertainment content being produced was concerned. So after that, yeah, like the prices were no longer low is what I'm trying to say. It was pretty high.
Like just to, if you aren't familiar with like the craze of Winter Sonata, like let me just tell you, people were taking pilgrimages, you know, like the way that people now go to the Swiss town and crush landing on you and like go and like take pictures of. This is what people were doing. They were going to these Winter Sonata filming sites in like droves. Like it was like the first K-drama tourism. It was wild. And people were crazy over what was Baeyong Jun? I think this was the actor who was in Winter Sonata. Like his hair became really trendy. There was like the scarf from Winter Sonata. It became really trendy. Like it was crazy.
Sort of like what Jennifer Aniston was doing over here.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of.
A few years earlier, yeah.
Yeah.
The writer of that drama had actually created 4 seasonally themed dramas amongst those times. So aside from Winter Sonata, there was Autumn in My Heart, I think. Mm-hmm. That was also really popular. So basically, you had a series of big hits. Now, these were all being created and broadcast by terrestrial TV, which we'll get to. We'll explain what that is a little later. But for now, let's talk about how these dramas were created, because that's interesting. So as you can see, Korean dramas, even back in the late 90s, they had a system of creating these limited episode dramas, producing them and distributing them. So the way they divided the labor was network, which are the channels that broadcast these dramas domestically, they would handle the distribution and financing. Whereas production houses, which were different companies, handled the actual creation of the dramas. Like they would do the shooting, the casting, the scripting, all of the actual making of the dramas. So I'm going to use an example of a company that's been around since then. It was involved in the production of Winter Sonata. Pan Entertainment is a production house, while KBS is, which is Korean Broadcasting System. It's like the oldest network.
Sort of like BBC, I guess.
It's kind of, yeah, because that it was originally created as a radio broadcast network in like the 1920s under obviously Japanese occupation. The Governor General of the time had created it. So it went through many transformations and stuff, and it's finally KBS at this point. It's publicly owned, as in like the state owns it, but it's independently run. But you can kind of guess how independent it is. Like its CEO and president is appointed by the president of the country. So, it's publicly owned basically. Anyway, so you had KBS, which is the network or the broadcast channel, pairing up with a production house like Pan Entertainment, and together they created Winter Sonata in 2002. Now, KBS paid a certain amount of money. So at that point, it was $2.5 million to Pan Entertainment to purchase the rights of this series, which they would air domestically. Later on, Pan Entertainment sold the broadcast rights to the series again to a Japanese network, NHK, for $16.7 million. They also sold the original soundtrack. They sold a lot of DVDs, which was another $110 million. I'm giving you these random numbers to make you understand that at that point, the network might be helping finance the drama's creation, but the people who held the right to the drama was Pan Entertainment, which was the production house. And the network had to buy the right to air it domestically. And of course, going forward, whoever owns the right can, you know, get money from like other networks or other countries adapting that drama in the future. So a lot of other ways of making profits. Anyway, initially, the dynamic between network and production houses stayed quite stable. The production houses owned the rights to the dramas. The network invested in and purchased licenses to the dramas. The production house might sell further airing rights to broadcast networks abroad for reruns. They might also profit from selling the original soundtrack or adaptation rights, like I told you guys. But then, of course, slowly, the networks, which are the channels, began to spawn their own production houses. Like KBS spawned KBS Media. or NBC, which is another network slash channel, spawned NBC CNI. See, these are production houses, obviously, which are set up in competition with other production houses, which are not connected to networks. So they could keep the rights under their own banner and reduce licensing costs. They will no longer have to pay, like, you know, huge licensing costs to production houses. And since they own the rights, they could sell it, you know, reruns, adaptations, soundtracks, etc. So they could increase their profits. It's getting very dry, isn't it?
No, I'm super interested.
Okay. You guys have, of course, heard of JTBC. That is a cable network. And they spawned JTBC Studios, which, by the way, currently...
Question.
Yeah.
As I understand it, JTBC is quite a young channel. So what year are we talking about? Or has JTBC been around a lot longer than we think?
So JTBC has been around since early 2010s. Both JTBC and TVN, which I was also going to mention, are...
Because they're sister channels, right?
They are not. They belong to different companies.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Why did I think they were sister channels?
Because you often see like them airing stuff around the same time. You kind of start connecting them.
Because they actually had, like, they have some airing agreements over certain dramas, right?
I don't think so, but they came onto the scene kind of around the same time with K-dramas. Like, you know, like they have kind of become the two cable channels that have like reliably good dramas.
Correct. Like the high budget dramas belong to either JTBC or TVN. And we'll kind of explain why that happened too. We'll get there. So just like KBS has KBS Media, NBC has their own studio. JTBC also has JTBC Studios, which is currently SLL, which is Studio Lululala. That's the name of this company. I love it. It sounds so adorable. It's not. It's an international, like one of those companies that are going around gobbling up international production companies.
It does sound cute.
Like, I guess just it's part of their image massaging to make themselves sound cute.
I looked this up on like Wikipedia and SLL being the acronym for Lululala, but the meaning of it is like expressing joy and adventure. So I guess they're experiencing joy and adventure.
They just bought an American production company called WIIP. So the invadee are about to become the invader.
Are they like the hype of K-drama world?
Wait, so now, so SLL bought JTBC or did they buy JTBC Studios?
No. SLL is a subsidiary of JTBC, and SLL went to America and bought WIIP, which is a production company, production house that is Hollywood production house.
So SLL is what is... Okay. So I misunderstood what you were saying because I thought that SLL bought JTBC Studios. Never mind.
SLL used to be JTBC Studios, right?
No, I know that. I just... When you said it's gobbling up, then I got confused that somebody else came in and... Yeah. But yeah, I hate that change, by the way.
I do. Too.
Like, I wish they had kept JTBC Studios. It was such a good brand.
It was a good brand, yeah.
It had brand recognition. When I saw that, I'd be like, oh, this is probably going to be good.
I mean, when Burma first sent the text with SLL, I was like, what's SLL?
Also, the funny thing is, now when you read certain excerpts in articles, and they are like, Hong, the CEO of SLL, is talking about how Netflix has too much market monopoly. You're like, who is this quaint little
the
company?
Like,
who is JT freaking BC? Okay. Also, we will get into who JTBC belongs to, but that comes later. Okay. So, also, the same company that owns TVN also owns Studio Dragon. Studio Dragon is also another production house. I don't want to confuse people too much. I know I'm throwing so much at you guys.
I think Studio Dragon has massive name recognition. Everyone has heard of Studio Dragon.
It does. But I am a little scared that I've told you guys so many names of so many broadcast channels that you might be a little confused at this point. So, to simplify...
Just sorry to slightly derail for a second. One of the things that the Netflixization of K-dramas has done is that we've lost the knowledge of where these dramas originally air. Like it used to be, you could be like, oh, that was an NBC drama. That was an SBS drama. That was a KBS drama. These days, it's like, it's a Netflix drama.
Or it's on Viki or it's on Vue. Right. It's just... But you know, that's actually funny. Around this period that I'm talking about, the early 2000s, early noughts, and even the first half of 2010s, around this period, we knew most of these dramas as like MBC dramas or, you know, JTBC dramas. But quite frequently, these dramas would actually belong to, like, the actual IP rights would belong to a production house that we would not know the names of. We just know the network that airs it. And that is how these dramas are usually talked about, too. Like, in articles and news clippings, when they talk about these dramas, they always talk about the network and not about the actual production house belonging. And maybe that is a system they're comfortable with, because I don't ever remember that being challenged. However... it does cause problems later on. All right. So to simplify what I was trying to tell you guys before, the networks then started spawning their own production houses. So networks like KBS, NBC, JTBC, and the company that owns channels like TVN, OCN, they all created their own production houses. That's all you guys need to know for now.
Okay. Wow, I'd forgotten about OCN.
Okay. So basically, each network was doing their best to control every aspect of the production, reducing competition and cost and keeping profits high. If you think about this from the labor perspective, given how closely these companies operated, if you got kicked out of one company for protesting against abuse or bad pay, it was unlikely you would get hired anywhere else. So they were not just creating an environment that helped them keep the profit within a few companies, monopolize it, but they were also making an impossible labor situation where they were forcibly keeping labor costs down and insane work hours. We remember in the early 2010s, a lot of articles came out about horrible things that were happening around that time. And the reason was this: even if they left that job, they would not have a career in the entertainment industry, because where would they go? Basically, there were like half of the entertainment industry was owned by either Jungang Corp or CJENM. These are separate groups, both of which have direct ties to the Samsung Group.
Oh, interesting.
And so where would you go? If you're blacklisted in any one of these companies or any of their subsidiaries, chances are you would not be able to find a place anywhere else. Okay, so this is the state. And then digital platforms sort of start entering the market. Now, if you guys remember in the early 2010s...
What year are we at now?
At this point, we are at the end of the noughts. We are at the beginning of 2010s. Beginning of 2010s, people weren't really taking digital platforms very seriously, but they were starting to slowly come out. We would just basically have like those small, cheap web series going to digital platforms.
Oh, yeah.
And they had very small viewership. So not to, because most of these were either free or subscription-based, right? And not too many people were comfortable with those platforms, especially when you had these big channels having like high production value dramas on them. Why would anybody pay to subscribe to those platforms? That was the state at that point. But in 2013, My Love from the Start, you guys remember that?
Of course.
Who could forget?
Exactly.
So My Love from the Start was licensed to iQIYI in China for dirt cheap, like I said, because digital platforms were looked down on. And nobody thought iQIYI would be able to bring in much profits. Except iQIYI brought in nearly $90 million for that one series that they paid less than $750,000 for the entire series. So suddenly, Korean Entertainment was like, wait, you can make money like that from licensing abroad? And obviously, this was happening in China, where you had like a huge number of people willing to, you know, watch these dramas on digital platforms. China was definitely one of the first places where digital platforms really took off.
And I mean, we've talked about Drama Fever before, but 2009 is when Drama Fever came onto the scene. And like you said, Borma, like it was subscription based and it was only really targeted towards like people who already knew and loved K-dramas. So it wasn't really a growth model, for example, the way that some other streaming services became
but
later on.
But Drama Fever, wasn't that more focused on a Western audience rather than...
It was. It was, I think, available in UK and US and Canada. Yeah.
It was very limitedly available in the UK. It was mainly North America.
It was mainly North America. Yeah. And it was mainly like directed towards fans of Asian dramas who already existed. Yeah. It wasn't really growing. I mean, the only thing that they did to try to grow to other markets or to expand their audience was like it started bringing telenovelas on and like Spanish language content, because I think there was a perception that like people who like K-dramas, like, I mean, people noticed some of the overlap in how content was, or it's maybe the themes of the content coming out of, you know, Spanish language television, like the way telenovelas kind of are similar to like, you know, mukbang dramas. Right. And so, I mean, I think that was their marketing strategy for a while, but it was still a very small audience. And I don't think that they were really, I don't think they really had a strategy of like attracting other audiences.
Like in a way,
that didn't already know about K-dramas.
It was cashing in on that existing audience who were, you know, who didn't have a legal means of watching the dramas that they were watching anyway.
And very it was the age of fan subbing. Because they stole fan subs from the Written in the Heavens subbing squad, and then had the audacity to like.
Which
send
was
out
the best fan subbing group ever.
They were so good. And then they were like sending out DMCA notices everywhere. Yeah. Meanwhile, they like didn't compensate any of these fan subbers for their labor. So yeah, very explicitly drawing on that existing fan base. And the excitement that people had to finally have like a legal place to pay for the content that they really loved, which, you know, at that time was an amazing boon. It was something that we could never have imagined before.
True. Although I think at the time there was a lot of bitterness because we loved our fan subbers.
Yeah, but I mean, like when Drama Fever first came on the scene, we were excited. And then the stuff about the fan subbers came out like a little later than that. Yeah. So anyway, go on. I'm not to interrupt your flow for him. I just wanted to bring up Drama Fever because it was happening at that same time.
I find that fascinating because like the few mentions I have read at that point in those years of international viewers, like Korean entertainment like companies, they were convinced that the only people watching abroad were Koreans, and like they didn't really seem to have a grasp on the growing international base of non-Koreans watching K-dramas in America or in a lot of other countries. And they were, we know that is how spaces like Soompi and Drama Beans, etc., like they grew. And it was during that period, like between 2007 and 2017, like it's like the entire growth and boom happened.
Yeah, like post Coffee Prince, My Name is Kim Samsoon, those dramas like that between like 2005, 2008, 2009, like, and then Dramas Over Flowers. I'm sorry, not Dramas, Boys Over Flowers. like during that stretch of like very popular, very viral, like very good, not all of them, but many of them, very
like
good
cult
dramas. Right. Right.
Huge.
Yeah. Very passionate fans. Yeah.
Yeah. So around this time, something else that was happening was there were two things, basically. One is that production companies were very split on, and when I say production companies and broadcasters, at this point, I primarily mean them being paired with terrestrial channels. Again, I'm going to explain what that means in a while. So MBC, SBS, those guys.
KBS,
sorry. Yeah.
Those are the big three. Yeah.
Those companies were like very torn on, because the budgets were slowly increasing. So in 2007, for instance, there was a blockbuster series called The Legend. And they had spent some $38 million at that time to produce it. The problem was that it was done really badly. Basically, the entire production schedule was really badly messed up. It was partly live shot. It was mostly live shot. Basically, the editing had not completed by the time the drama started airing. So it was a huge botch up. Everybody was like, what the hell was going on? So it was like a cautionary tale. So they were like, well, the live shoot model was like a favorite with, you know, the Korean entertainment industry. Except when you have that kind of money riding on it, live shoot has so many problems. What if another Legend happens?
To add a little note there, The Legend was a Song Jin-ah drama, I think 2007 you said, right?
Yeah.
And the director that she frequently worked with, Kim Jong-hak, he eventually committed suicide because just this happened a lot. He was in a lot of debt. Things yeah. went really badly. It was a, you know, it was an awful situation. Mm. I think there's still dramas that he was the director for where the staff, the crew and actors weren't even paid. Like, that's how bad the situation was. And that eventually, like, the pressure and, like, you know, everything that he went through led him to take his life. And that's, you know, that's how bad it was.
Yeah, exactly. That's how bad
this
it was.
This is the same director and writer who produced, you know, some of our favorites, like Faith. Song Jin-ho, who wrote Healer as well. Again, a favorite drama.
Yeah.
Yeah, just for some drama context.
Exactly. That was the kind of situation they were in. So because the industry was growing, but they didn't really have the structure to...
Can I also, sorry, before you move on to the next point, I can also add, and I knew this, but I wanted to fact check just to make sure that I was, but Song Jin-ho and Kim Jong-uk also worked on Sandglass.
Oh, right. Wow. Seminal dramas.
So they were big deals. Sandglass is like an iconic.
Eyes of Dawn as well?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So like these are not like small potatoes people. Mm. So for people like that who had such amazing success, I mean, Sandglass is one of the most successful dramas of all time. People still talk about it as like a drama that they can never forget. And like the experience of watching it was like a national experience, you know? And so for people like that to not be able to like pay their crew and staff and, you know, like that's just,
yeah,
that's so, that's just means like it's bad for everybody. Yeah.
True. And it's they completely lose the trust of people who would work with them, but also financiers. Like none of their projects in the future would get financed. It's a horrible situation to be in. You had a pretty stable environment in the like most of the 2000s, where the industry was growing comfortably. But now, between the live shoot model and the growing production budget, things were starting to get a bit shaky. And then things started solidly shifting when Descendants of the Sun aired in early 2016. It's important to know that it aired in early 2016 because of what happens at the end of 2016. Now, Descendants of the Sun was completely pre-produced. Now, again, this drama has its own saga backstory of how it nearly didn't get made. Because nobody wanted to put that much money into a drama that was going to be shot abroad in foreign land, but also a drama where the male lead only wears uniform and like nothing, you know, no snazzy suits, no sparkly.
They underestimate the power of Sun Jung-gi.
Right? No sparkly jumpsuit that's handmade in Italy. So
stitch by stitch.
Stitch by stitch.
Stitch by stitch. That's a Secret Garden reference for those who don't haven't seen that drama.
So with all of those things working against the drama, poor drama, it finally goes to floor. KBS takes it up. Actually, SBS was originally supposed to air both Descendants of the Sun and Signal for that matter. But what ends up happening is... yeah. Initially, both dramas were supposed to go with SBS, but SBS sites... basically not being able to fund the production. So it goes to TVN, like Signal goes to TVN and Descendants of the Sun goes to KBS. Anyway, Descendants of the Sun goes to the floor, is bought by iQIYI, is majorly successful everywhere. Basically anywhere anybody saw Descendants of the Sun, it definitely created another Hallyu wave.
I remember that like even Channel 4, which is a UK broadcast, company, group, whatever, they had bought the rights to Descendants of the Sun. And I remember being excited, oh, is it going to be on Channel 4? It wasn't, but they did buy the rights to it.
Hmm. So apparently Descendants of the Sun was bought and dubbed in some Indian languages. Now, I never saw it aired, but apparently it aired in India too. So It like they were that sure about it. And you had distributors going and selling it to countries where they usually wouldn't be selling the rights to these.
They sold it everywhere.
It sold it everywhere.
Lipstick that Song Hye-kyo was wearing became like impossible to buy because everyone was buying it. Like,
really? I remember that happening with You from Another Star, which has a proper official title. The Jung Ji-hyun's lipstick in that as well.
Mm. Yeah. My Love from the Star. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of other things, like the clothes they were wearing, any kind of like fashion item, all of those things sold out. So pre-production had finally come into its heyday. Like people were like, fine. So if we have a big budget thing, it must be pre-produced. So that is how the shift in this industry started happening. However, around the same time, the THAAD missile testing situation happened, which basically there was this military operation that was happening. It was like a friendly operation that was happening between Korea and America. And they were doing these anti-missile testing. I don't know what that entire system is, but basically they were being too buddy-buddy and China didn't like it. So China was like, stop it right now. And Korea was like, ha, no. And then China was like, fine, all of your entertainment content is banned. And like China knew perfectly well how much Korean entertainment depended on Chinese funds. Because, okay, I'm going back again in time. So you have early 2010s, this entire situation is happening where if a production fails, a big budget production, especially because of live shooting, things go wrong, or a drama just doesn't take, entire companies were basically getting wiped off the face of the earth. It was a horribly volatile market. In this situation, in 2013, like after 2013, when Aichi bought Your My Love from the Stars and they, you know, South Korea had another hope, digital platform, especially digital platform in China and other Asian markets where their dramas could do really well. Well, that was a new source of income. Around this time, Chinese investors began heavily putting money into Korean dramas, like these limited episode dramas. And it was that investment that helped create dramas like Descendants of the Sun and Moon Lover Scarlet Heart Rio. So these dramas got sold for a lot of money, like their airing rights as well as digital rights got sold for a lot of money abroad. Okay, so at this point, you have Korean drama companies and broadcasters utterly dependent on Chinese investors to fund, you know, their grand ambitions. Now, I will explain what the difference is between terrestrial network and cable network. Terrestrial network can also be thought of as public network, public TV, kind of like your BBC.
Your free TV.
Your free TV.
Free-to-view TV, yeah.
Correct. So you have your free to view and you have your paid, and predictably free to view belongs to the state, paid are privately owned.
Not all of them are though.
Wait, what are you talking about?
I'm saying KBS, NBC and SBS are not all publicly owned. KBS is publicly owned.
They're all publicly owned.
They're all publicly owned?
All of them. I looked them up.
When you say publicly owned, what do you mean?
When they aren't owned directly by the government, they are owned by some pensioners company.
Oh, okay. So even if nominally they're not publicly owned, they're still publicly owned. Okay. Thanks for clearing that up.
I mean, the semantics are important.
Listen, when I say I deep dived.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, because I always thought KBS was the only one that was like properly publicly owned and the other two just got some public money, but they were independent. So
No, they're not. KBS is the biggest one, it's the oldest one, and it's the one that's like brand Korea. So that is front and center. They absolutely acknowledge that they are publicly owned. The rest of them are also dependent on government funds, but they are like owned in such an indirect way that you could kind of be like, but we are independently run. We are not that tied with the government. Okay. So now, while everything that I said was happening, there also started an internal struggle between public TV and cable TV. So you have public TV that is state-owned and funded by a mandatory licensing fee, which comes to, at this point, like right now with like, I think the latest hike and stuff, it's like $2.5 per household. And so it's very nominal. And like the last time they tried
per
to hike
what?
The price, I think per month. And the last time they tried to hike the price, like I think the entire country came to a halt or something. It was like a majorly horrible situation. It's really hard to hike the mandatory fee.
Not here, it's not. Sorry, go on.
So they're majorly dependent on that licensing fee and also on like advertising, of course. But like it's something like 50% of their income comes from the household, licensing fee. while cable TV is pay to view. So, of course, privately owned, very dependent on advertising, but also very much on a subscription model. Okay, but not streaming subscription. It's cable TV subscription. Different things.
It's like, this is like, it's literally cable. You get
it's
your...
literally cable. Everybody yeah. knows what cable is.
Okay, we know cable.
So, by mid-2010s, JTBC, the channel, this is a privately owned cable channel, owned by Jungang Corp, and TVN, also a privately owned cable channel, owned by CJENM, these two were starting to stand out as major players in high-quality K-drama production. Later on, these two networks will end up becoming major partners with Netflix. But that is not the story right now.
That's a spoiler, P.
That's a spoiler. These two networks, they were slowly eating up the pie that had majorly been owned by public broadcast system till now, till the early 2010s. Now, so the public networks were at this point majorly losing out on advertising money. Now, we know about this. This is happening world over. This wasn't just South Korea. But companies like, you know, endorsement companies, just product companies, they were moving away from advertising on television and were slowly advertising more on digital, like Facebook. And what this was doing was it was a huge blow to public networks because such a large chunk of their income comes from advertising and they can't really increase the mandatory household fees. So how do they increase their income? They can't. They have this fixed income that is the mandatory fee and the advertising budget of the companies that were going to these major broadcasters are slowly dwindling. It's shrinking. So at this point, NBC, KBS, SBS, these companies started to suffer and they didn't know what to do. They were also like these mammoth companies, these behemoths, right? So for instance, they were having the hardest time moving from the live shoot to the pre-production. The idea of it was slowing them down. They had like a lot of corporate like meetings and meetings and meetings and nothing was happening.
Yeah, so like a large public company is never going to be as nimble as like a new, you know, smaller private company because you just can't.
Exactly.
Move
like
the same
that's
way.
Profit oriented. So even though, you know, they were getting state funding to stay afloat, obviously year on year, they were depending more on state funding instead of their other alternate ways of getting money. So what was happening was they weren't being able to produce those high quality K-dramas anymore. Like I said, SBS had to let go of Descendants of the Sun, which, it did go to another publicly funded company. But the reason for that was cash crunch on SBS. And as Anisa pointed out, KBS has always been kind of like the favorite child of the government. Like that is your brand Korea broadcasting system. So they would always get a bit of favoritism as far as government funding is concerned. That is my speculation. I am not quoting anybody. It's what I got from reading a lot. Okay. So that is what was happening around that time. And cable was thriving. The ad budget that had shifted to digital was also actually going a little more towards cable. Plus, they were pay-to-view, so they were directly being able to get money from the public. And they could hike that money without, like, I don't know, strikes happening, public throwing, I don't know, their shoes at them. So they were doing all of that. They had a lot more control over their income.
And I would add also, it had become a lot more attractive to writers, directors, actors, because they could make shows on cable that they couldn't on these terrestrial networks because the terrestrial networks had a lot of requirements around, regulations around what you're allowed to see on television. Like, do you remember, I remember like Secret Garden, there was a lot of kissing in the final episode. They got dinged for that. Like, also, like, especially during that period when Park Geun-hye was in power, it was a more conservative government. And like, there was a lot stricter enforcement of these like content regulations on the big three networks.
Blacklisting at that period as well.
Right? Yeah, there was a lot of cable was kind of like, well, you know, if we don't want to deal with all of that, we can go to cable. We can make these like edgier, more creative, more risky kind of projects. So it became more attractive to the creative people who were making this stuff too.
Although it wasn't completely free of like the regulation.
It wasn't, but it's like cable versus broadcast, right? It's different.
because later the story is that you go to Netflix to tell the stories you can't tell.
Exactly. So around that time, in 2016, when all of these things were happening, when the ground was shifting away from terrestrial TV towards cable TV, highly paid A-list writers like Kim Yoon-hee and Kim Yoon-suk, who were like, you know, respectively mystery thriller writers and romantic comedy writers, they were contracted by TVN, which was the private channel, to write Signal and The Guardian, the Lonely and Great God, the Kibbe, basically. Goblin.
Wasn't that Kim and So? Oh, right. Kim and
Suk. So it was Kim Yoon-hee who wrote Signal and Kim Yoon-suk who wrote Goblin. And they were both contracted by TVN. And these are A-list huge writers. And both of them gave interviews explaining why they shifted to TVN, because they were loyal writers of like one of the public broadcasting companies.
SBS.
I remember it being a pretty big deal at the time that they took that leap.
Like, public broadcasting had till now been treating the cable TV interlopers as like small players that no, you know, big prestigious writers and directors would want to go to. So they were kind of like being sidelined. But now they were poaching their big, you know, creatives.
Right.
And this phase, this the thing that is happening in 2016, this is where you are at when Hwayugi airs 2 episodes and China bans all entertainment import from Korea over the THAAD missile situation. This is end 2016.
Wow.
Suddenly, Korean entertainment industry, there's like pin drop. Like they don't know what to do. So much investment just dried up. Like such a huge market just disappeared overnight. And everybody was just waiting to see what happens. Does it last a few weeks, a few months? Like what? And as we know now, it's actually still kind of in place. It's sort of a bit loosened up. Like they do allow some dramas to air because, of course, piracy never stopped. But so they were allowing, but the criteria for like getting dramas through their censorship became really harsh. So it was much harder to get more dramas in there. Now, I actually have my own speculations about this. I honestly think that aside from the whole THAAD missile crisis, I think a lot of local Chinese drama production companies were really sore about the fact that Korean content was eating up their airspace, so to speak. And this was the government helping homegrown content. But that is my speculation again. And so, yeah, this is the situation. And now Netflix peeps into the market and knocks to see who opens the door. And I think we should kind of leave the thing over there, because who opens the door is really interesting, and I want to do that. I want to open the next episode with that.
This is your cliffhanger.
This is your teaser. No, it's a teaser next time.
The preview.
Yes, that's
and
a preview.
And I promise the story is so interesting. There is like backstabbing, betrayal. There are like oaths. And breaking of oaths and like just wow.
I'm so interested.
I'm excited. Forma has this whole amazing prep doc, and she was like, "You can read my notes." I was like, "No. I want to hear it from you." And this has been amazing. So I'm not reading the rest of the notes either. Yeah. I'm like waiting to hear from you from next time.
Also, can I say your storytelling is top notch?
Yes. Oh, amazing.
Thank you.
I'm ceding my title of K-drama professor to you, Forma.
No, unless I write a thesis, I don't think that's allowed. I think you get to keep it for many, many more years.
You practically have written a thesis. I took a skim. That's very detailed and in-depth and full of citations.
It's definitely a research paper for sure.
So. Okay. So
Forma blushes and pretends she didn't get complimented. Yes, we understand. Yeah, I'm just glad it's not me.
So next time we're going to go more into how Netflix does make an entry, because it's actually harder than Netflix just coming in and being like, "We are here, welcome us." things weren't that easy, and how it actually, not just Netflix, but streaming itself starts changing the industry.
This is like a true crime, but like true K-drama. It doesn't have the skeeviness of true crime. This is like, you know, it's corporate big wig backstabbery. It's really, you know, you don't have to feel morally delinquent going into that.
this is the drama I like. Like, I never understood the appeal of true crime, honestly.
Me neither. I
but what I hate about it is this sort of sensationalizing, making up stuff about people that didn't happen that there's no verification for. Like, I find case studies interesting, but I don't like the way that it's turned into this sort of juicy story.
All right. Well, join us next time. We'll be on the case. Borma's on the case. She's going to bring it to us.
Shall we leave it there for this episode? And if you want to speculate on what's going to happen in the next episode, I guess tweet at us.
Yeah, where can people tweet at us?
They can tweet at us at Dramas Overflow. And you can find me at Not Now Saya.
You can find me at Anisa Khalifa _.
You can find me, Porma, at The Drama Notes. You can find us on Instagram at dramasoverflowers_. And you can email us at dramasoverflowers@gmail.com.
And you can find our website, dramasoverflowers.net. And our newsletter, which you can subscribe to right now, is at dramasoverflowers.substack.com. Or you can click the link in the description below.
And also for, like, because we said a lot of names and numbers and stuff, I'm going to put links for you guys to read. Like, nothing too heavy if you don't want to. But just, you know, if you're curious, want to read a little more about how things are going and how things have been going, I'll put some links for you to read below. And if you want to know more about any of the things that we discuss, like we said, hit us up and I will send you. You want to read research papers, I will send you in their direction.
Forma has the receipts is basically what you're saying.
Right. Okay.
All right.
Thank you for joining us. Until next time. Bye.
Bye. Bye.